you. My name is Hobie Perry, and I'm working with another colleague. There's a tradition for us to go by our middle names in the Northern Research Station, Ty Wilson. And what I'd like to speak about today is some of our efforts to take our point estimates, our point measurements, excuse me, of soil carbon and try to distribute those across the landscape. And in this particular instance, we're using gradient nearest neighbor imputation techniques. So some basic questions that I'm going to address today is, who are we in FIA? What is imputation? Speak about where we found carbon and what our models have to suggest about carbon distributions. And then recently there's been a lot of discussion within the institution about the future of the carbon program, so I think that's something worth mentioning as well. First, it's important to recognize that working for FIA, the program has national program goals. And it's important to remember that it's a strategic inventory designed to address a few significant questions at the broadest possible scale. Okay, so when I talk about the measurements we're taking and our results, it's important to bear in mind that what we're doing is very different from a site-specific or site-intensive evaluation and measurement. So we're going to come at this from a very different perspective. Our first goal has historically been to estimate the extent of forest land, which meets a very strict definition, which of course is another issue we could spend a lot of time talking about. Also addressing the volume, growth, and removal of forest resources. But then from my perspective, the most interesting part is that since the Farm Bill in the late 90s, we've been tasked with addressing the health and condition of the forest. And so while there's been a traditional focus on the timber resources, we now also are charged with measuring things like downwoody material, ozone, understory vegetative communities, and for us here this morning, soil resources. For those of you who don't know much about FIA, FIA samples in what we call phases. Here's an example from the state of Minnesota. The first phase uses satellite remote sensing information to stratify the landscape into forest and non-forest, because we want to be able to make statistically valid estimates, or at least be able to put confidence intervals around our estimates. The second phase then, this is very hard to see, but this is an extremely fine mesh of hexagons. If you imagine turning the United States into a big soccer ball and then subdividing those hexagons into smaller and smaller hexagons, we take our P2 measurements, or our traditional tree measurements, and hexagons that are roughly 2,400 hectares, roughly 6,000 acres. Within each of those hexagons, a random point is selected. If that point falls on a stand of trees that meets our definition of forest, which by the way has to be at least an acre and at least 120 feet wide, so things like windbreaks or those kinds of things don't meet our definition, then a field crew goes out and takes measurements. And then for us here, this phase three portion then is where the forest health measurements are taken. So imagine that if you've got a very fine mesh here, if you put 16 of those hexagons together, you'd get one P3 hexagon. So one out of every 16 of these phase two plots is selected as a phase three plot, where these additional measurements are taken, assessing, as I mentioned before, soil quality, understory vegetation, downwoody material, and things of that nature. It's also important to bear in mind that our sampling uses a nationally consistent plot design. I didn't design this plot. A lot of people get very upset about this, but these are the plots that we were given. Blame the statisticians. They like these subplots that are distributed across the landscape. This distance between these is roughly 120 feet, and the measurement where the tree measurements are taken, this subplot is roughly 24 feet in radius. The soil measurements, being destructive sampling, occurs off the plot. We're not allowed to do any destructive sampling on the plot. So immediately adjacent to the subplot, there is a soil sampling frame. And since it's destructive and we intend to do this in a repeated measurement, we take a sample and then intervening years we simply hop back and forth along our sampling line. Another issue that folks frequently raise is the number of samples collected. So I'll just get that out in the open right now. I see smiles in the background. Traditionally, when the program started, we had grand visions, and there were mineral soil samples collected on these three subplots. Budget constraints and recent budget priorities have restricted us to collecting mineral soil samples at this location. So I'll just be upfront about that right now. Forest soil samples are still collected at all three locations. So we can discuss that as well. Here's the challenge as I see it. Every one of these blue dots, and it might be hard to see, but these are actually dots in here. Every one of these blue dots is where we take tree measurements. And what would be really great would be if we could turn these red dots into blue dots. The red dots are where we have soil measurements. And so what we're trying to figure out is how to turn every blue dot into a red dot so that we can get well-distributed estimates of soil properties across the landscape. So that's the challenge that I'm trying to address. And in this particular example of the Lake States, we've got 700 soil plots and 16,000 P2 plots, or the tree plots. Here's one solution that we've begun to use. Gradius near neighbor imputation, which was introduced in 2002, traditionally to look at trying to evaluate vegetative communities using remote sensing data. So using multispectral remote sensing data and finding correspondences to distribute and create a multidimensional feature space and separate your plots and then use some sort of nearest neighbor approach to then assign the plots to plots you haven't measured. How does this work? Here's a conceptual model. Imagine that you've got all of the blue dots and red dots here in the upper part of Lower Peninsula of Michigan. The first step is to take your red dots, your soil data, and find the correspondences that exist and try to find properties in the landscape that help identify and differentiate between your different plots. And so you combine and discover different axes of predictors, which I'll mention in a minute, to help spread your red dots out as far as possible in multiple dimensions. Then you go out and you apply that same information to the broader landscape and assign your blue dots in the same feature space. So now we take our blue dots and we drop them in the same feature space. Here's only two dimensions, but imagine multiple dimensions. The idea then is to find the nearest neighbor, your nearest blue dot, the nearest red dot to the blue dot, and simply take the soil properties assigned for this point and give them to that blue dot. So conceptually, that's what we're doing. Now, what information do we have to do this? We took all of the plots collected in the previous five-year cycle, and fortunately, these three lake states all intensified their sampling because these states are very interested in their forest resources. So we had more plots than might be available in other parts of the country. And what we used as response variables was our entire suite of soil properties. I didn't simply use carbon as the response. I used everything we measured as a response because we're hoping that we can predict not just carbon, but the complete suite of soil properties. And because of unit issues, we transform these into dimensionless Z values. As a predictor, well, as the whole thing about CCA is you sort of have to invert your predictors and your responses. Our variables across the landscape that we're using to help differentiate our variables, our plots, is this set right here. We've got latitude and longitude. We've got forest floor mass, carbon and nitrogen. And then we've got, these are our soil variables. These are all of the properties that we're trying to estimate. So we're using these and differentiating these in our feature landscape. Our predictors, we tried to look at the basic soil forming factors. So we took things that were distributed in the GIS, things like climate. We could get gridded patterns of precipitation, gridded patterns of temperature. We have all of the tree data, so where do we see which species? We have things related to topography. Parent material is something we neglected because of the complications there, and how to account for time. We're not exactly sure. We could potentially use something related to the retreat of glaciers, but that's not something we included at this point. Just to go through real quickly, we didn't simply use the mean temperature. We used Fourier to try to get at not just the mean value, but how it varies over time. Here are our predictors and the relative importance of each in the landscape as our predictor set, and you'll notice all of the blue bars are our climate-driven variables. They tended to be the most important predictors in helping differentiate our plots from each other. And interestingly enough, and disappointing for those of us that are interested in trees, the trees were actually surprisingly less useful at helping to identify our plots relative to one another. Most of our plots had 100 or fewer neighbors. So remember, we've got 700 plots going to 16,000. You're going to have many, many neighbors. Most of them had 100 or less, but interestingly, one plot was plotted across the landscape 457 times. That identified some unique feature in the landscape. And we can end up with maps like this. So we could differentiate the amount of forest floor carbon across the landscape, or we could map the amount of mineral soil carbon, in this instance, from 0 to 10 centimeters, or from 10 to 20 centimeters. The question is, how does this relate to other estimates that exist or other opportunities that we might have to model soil carbon? It was very disappointing, I must admit. This is looking at using the general soil maps, so the data you can download from the Soil Data Mart, and our estimates, and you can see things look really grim. Things look very, very grim. And I was dazed and confused for quite a while trying to sort this out. So what we did is we started to look at where are we sampling and where do the characteristic pedons come from. And this is quite enlightening to see where the traditional pedons come from and where we have measured. And it looks kind of like a complementary data set, which I think begins to raise some very serious issues about doing things like using StatsGo to estimate soil carbon across the landscape, which is what we very commonly do. For example, if we look at the distribution of plots, the bars represent the distribution of pedons, and the numbers represent the distribution of forests. So in Michigan, the pedons are distributed 67% in non-forest and 33% in forest, whereas the state's actually 50% forest. So we're undersampling the forest in the database, and yet we're using that for reporting purposes. And if we look across the lake states as a whole, we're substantially underestimating or undermeasuring the soils that then gets used in these nationwide databases. So then I started to look at where are we seeing a lot of differences between our estimates and the generalized soil map. The green represents where the generalized soil map has more carbon than we predict, and the purple represents where we have more carbon than the generalized soil map. And you can see large areas where there is more carbon predicted by the generalized soil map. If we lay the P2 plots over, and I should point out these are all public plot locations. I can't tell you where the real plots are. No, for real. But if you need to do that, we can talk about that. If you look at where the green is, you'll notice that the dark green shows up. And there's some interesting patterns here. You'll see basically what's going on. So for example, right here there's a blue dot. So we're trying to estimate carbon in the forest, but the map unit is of a much different size. So where we aren't sampling intensively, there's a big difference between the estimate from the generalized soil maps versus our estimates. We're simply trying to estimate different things. As opposed to where there's a lot of overlap, you're seeing much less difference. The estimates are much more coincident with each other. The boundary waters is a very interesting exception to that, and I think, quite frankly, that's due to the fact that you've got a lot of peaty soils up in that part of the landscape, and I'll be honest and say we do not sample histosols very well. So that's a problem that we have with our sampling. But by and large, it's this prairie forest transition or ag forest transition where we're having a lot of differentiation going on. So next steps include trying to refine our modeling approaches and figuring out ways to include parent material or other organism variables, including the understory vegetative community. Some folks think that that might be especially useful. There's another question that we need to address is, would we be better off by simply trying to impute carbon alone rather than this complete family of soil properties? It also would be interesting to look at other databases that might exist. I know that, I don't see Ivan here this morning, but Ivan's working hard at collecting a lot of information for Maine, and he and I are trying to put our databases together and see what that looks like. But I think it's also worth bearing in mind and mentioning here in this venue that the soil quality indicator may have a relatively short future, that as part of the continuing constraints on the FIA budget to get into more states, they're looking at eliminating the suite of forest health variables entirely. And so it was originally envisioned to be a repeated measures program to document change over time may in fact not do that. Which is kind of disappointing considering that the amount of money to be saved by eliminating the program is surprisingly small. It's relatively cheap to actually do this. So I'd mention that. I'm not allowed to lobby Congress in any way working for the federal government, but I'll just point out that there are some issues there that may be relevant to those of you that don't work for the federal government. So for those of you that have any Questions or comments after today, feel free to give me a call and I'd love to talk about what we're doing. So thank you very much.